Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick, and it's October, and though we cover horror movies a lot on this show, I guess we have to do some really intense horror this month, and so what better time to introduce our very first Lucio Fulci movie on Weird House?
That's right, Lucio Fulci's 1981 film, The House by the Cemetery. This is a bloody and bonkers tale that has multiple elements in it that I think are worth geeking out over. And it also feels, on some level, it feels like the perfect film to discuss this week, because as of this week, Weird House Cinema has completed its first journey around the sun. We've been doing these episodes for a year now, and you've been either putting up with them or enjoying them with us for a year, and so we appreciate that.
Now, Rob, this movie was your pick, so I assume you must have some kind of personal history with it. What is your connection to House by the Cemetery?
I think it was the first Fulci film that I saw that really connected with me. The first film where I felt like, I mean, there, even his worst films, his less celebrated films, there's generally something enjoyable in them. But sometimes if you're not really a connoisseur, it's easy to get caught up on the things that don't work. Uh-huh. And so I think I'd had that experience with some of his other films, like New York Ripper, and is it New York Ripper? Yeah,
I think so. Yeah. I've never seen that one.
And Manhattan Baby, which is a wonderful. I love the title Manhattan Baby because it kind of implies a certain a B cinema international idea of what New York was. Mm-hmm. And therefore you could just put the word Manhattan in front of baby and it takes on sinister qualities. Mm-hmm. But those were all films where I think I saw more of the flaws than the genius. And in this film, the genius stood out to me. So I was really excited to revisit it. And I found that in revisiting it, I got to appreciate all the bonkers stuff a lot more. I feel like my memory had kind of selectively cut out a lot of the weirder plot holes in this film. And I mainly remembered like a really great monster. I remembered some weird scenes and some heightened tension. But ultimately, this is just a wonderful, weird pick.
Well, so we've been talking recently a number of times about specifically about these rub the fur movies, movies that are more about a vision of audiovisual texture than they are about the narrative contents of the film. And it's funny that Fulci never came up when we were talking about these before, because I think in the most disgusting possible way, Fulci was deeply committed to making rub the fur type movies. Cinema as a almost purely aesthetic exercise over a narrative one. And so I've seen a number of Fulci horror movies, and I can't remember a single one of them for its characters or plot. Instead, what you remember from these movies are scenes and images. So I tend to think of Fulci as I think of his approach to movie making as kind of similar to a child creating shoebox dioramas, except, of course, they're strewn with ludicrous amounts of blood and gore. So he has like an extraordinary eye for these memorable set pieces of weirdness and wet violence. But on the narrative level, these scenes and the characters in them always feel just barely held together by the vaguest of narrative logic. Every Fulci movie I have ever seen feels like it takes place in a dream, where in every scene, you know, it's like that moment in a dream where some things are going on around you, but you couldn't necessarily explain how you got there or why.
Now, like a dream, what I've done in the past with Fulci movies is afterwards I kind of reflect on the dream and sort of ascribe it a structure, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like you can certainly do that with a film like this. You can be like, okay, well, this was at heart a film about a house that is haunted. People move into said haunted house, have encounters with the haunt, and, you know, there are consequences for all of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically the plot. But what we actually witness on screen is a lot more, I don't know, frenzied. And like you say, kind of definitely follows the logic or the lack of logic found in dreams.
Yeah. And like you're saying, I mean, actually, it's kind of hard to describe because his movies do, in fact, have plots and they have characters. So House by the Cemetery, which we just watched, is a movie that technically has a story that you could summarize in words. It's more that it just doesn't really feel that way when you're watching it. You know, like you could write out a plot summary and it would more or less make sense. It's just that scene to scene, I at least don't feel the normal levels of narrative logic that you would in a movie where the plot hangs together like it should. Instead, once again, what we get is more like a collection of images, shots, set pieces, and scenes as if billowing out of a dream and then kind of haphazardly strung together along a pretty standard kind of horror plot arc.
I think one aspect of this or one reason for this is that I don't think Fulci was ever the sort of director to let the plot get in the way of a great shot.
You know,
if there was something visually interesting to be done, it seems like he would do it even if it wasn't really helping out the plot all that much.
Not even plot. I mean, just to let any kind of logic or reality get in the way of a good shot. So,
yeah.
Say, the laws of physics, you know, he will show some kind of bizarre murder that he maybe came to him in a dream or whatever. And it doesn't really matter if this is not how, like, fluids flow in the real world or if this is, you know, it doesn't really, gravity would interfere with what he wants to be showing you. He's just going to show it.
Yeah.
You know, another thing that's kind of interesting about Fulci's horror movies is that though they are classifiable as horror and they generally have, you know, ghosts and zombies, supernatural horror plot elements, I don't know if they're really intended to be scary. I never really find them scary. They're more like disgusting psychedelic art films.
Yeah, this film in particular, it feels like it's trying to be haunting and supernatural. It's definitely going out there to be gory, but really there's only like one sequence of a child in peril that felt suspenseful. I don't know, maybe the opening kill sequence is a little bit suspenseful, even though you don't really have a firm attachment to any of the characters.
Okay, so what's the elevator pitch on this one? Absurdly grisly murders keep happening at the old Freudstein house. Let's watch what happens when a new family moves in.
Don't you mean Oak Manor? Isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
The realtors keep insisting, don't call it the Freudstein house.
God, I love the cutaways to the real estate office.
Yeah, we got a strong real estate agent subplot in this.
Yeah, and the real estate office was strangely political compared to, you know, there was nothing else in the movie like this. But in the real estate office, there are a bunch of flags. There's like an American flag and then some other flags. I don't know what they were. And then there's a might have been state flags or something. And then there's a framed portrait of John F. Kennedy, and there's a big bust of an eagle. I don't know why it was so patriotic in there.
Interesting. All right, well, let's go ahead and hear the audio for some of the trailer audio. Maybe we'll play the whole trailer because this is a fun one, and I'll explain why after you hear it.
Stephen, where are you? Please answer me. Steve!
In this house, what you don't know will hurt you. It was to be a getaway dream. It's becoming a runaway nightmare.
Do you see anything?
Some old steps going down.
He has been awaiting the arrival of his new guests. One by one, they are disappearing. One by bloody one.
No! No! No!
When you move to this house, before you get locked in,
there's someone in
read
here,
the fine print.
Mommy, hurry!
You may have just mortgaged your life. Due to the graphic nature of this film, no one under 18 will be admitted. House by the cemetery.
All right, so you might have noticed, well, that's not our typical movie narrator. That's a slightly different voice of God. Doesn't sound like a God at all. Maybe a devil is narrating this. Well, that devil is Brother Theodore, the comedian and character actor that we discussed in the Warhawk Tanzania film, The Devil's Express. You might also know him from The Burbs and the animated adaptations of The Hobbit and The Last Unicorn. He was the voice of Gollum in the animated Hobbit film. And here he is narrating a trailer. I love it.
In The Devil's Express, he was the street preacher who in one scene was giving a sermon by the subway entrance about how all your gods are dead and the rats are screaming.
I was looking around trying to figure out what other trailers he narrated, and I couldn't find evidence of a lot of them. So I don't know if this was like just a very brief gig for him or if I'm missing a lot of trailers here. But I wish he had done more. I wish he was still around to do film trailers. Like any kind of Oscar bait comes out, I want to hear Brother Theodore narrate it.
How would he say it featuring the personable Mark Damon?
it'd be good. Well, speaking of humans, let's get into the humans involved in bringing this strange film to life. First, I guess we'll begin with the director here. The key individual we've already brought up already, that's Lucio Fulci, who lived 1927 through 1996. So we've mentioned him multiple times on Weird House Cinema. So it's ultimately nice to finally discuss him in one of his own films instead of just, you know, referring to people who worked with him. He's best remembered today for his horror films of mainly the 1980s era, I guess is the big time for him. And it's he is without a doubt one of the titans of Italian B cinema from this era. But all of this really kicked into high gear after 1979's Zombie came out. We've talked about this one before. This was a very prolific period of his career that produced some of his best remembered films.
Now, this is Zombie with just an I instead of an IE. Is this the one that was marketed as an unofficial sequel to Dawn of the Dead?
Yeah. It was very much cashing in on the success of that film. And it is also, you may remember us discussing some of the bonkers scenes in this. This is another one where he didn't let the plot get in the way of an interesting scene, such as the one where a shark and a zombie battle each other while a topless scuba diver swims by. Just, you know, completely bonkers and definitely stands out in one's memory. But he'd been active for a while prior to Zombie. He'd been directing full-length films for 20 years at that point, including some horror films such as 1971's A Lizard in a Woman's Skin, 1972's Don't Torture a Duckling. He also did a 1969 giallo film titled One on Top of the Other. But he directed a number of different genre films before the 1980s, including westerns, spy thrillers, comedies, and more. He did an adaptation of Jack London's White Fang. He also did a fantasy film, 1983's Conquest, which is quite entertaining and weird. Maybe we'll come back to that one.
Conquest can sometimes be kind of rough because it looks like it was filmed through cloth. Like there is an impenetrable haze through the entire movie. It looks like there was gauze over the camera lens or something, how I think they would normally describe it. It's just this gray, hazy look that never ends. But Conquest stars, so it's like one of those barbarian movies, sort of a Conan ripoff. But it's got Jorge Rivera from Werewolf as the Conan character.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it has a number of fun elements in it. I wonder, though, if you're... One of the things about these films is that some of us saw them years ago with less than great formats. Mm-hmm. Maybe we even saw them on VHS. So I wonder if the version of Conquest you saw was a more recent restoration of it, or if it was older, because the film we're talking about here today was recently restored in 2K. And that was the version that I watched in preparation for this episode. And it really did seem a lot clearer than I remember watching it, 10 or 15 years ago.
Same. Yeah, this one, it looks a lot better now than the version I saw about 15 years ago. But one more note about one of the movies you mentioned. I've actually seen A Lizard in Woman's Skin. That's a Fulci giallo movie that is very strange. It involves... I think it's one of the number of these Italian gialli that take place in London, if I remember correctly. And it involves like a party house. There's like a it's like a total. I think the plot is the main character and her husband live in one part apartment, and then right next door there's a total party house, and she has these like dreams and visions about weird stuff going on in there. I think it's kind of naked people and panthers wandering around and stuff.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, the title on that one has to do with the success of Dario Argento's The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. And if you start looking at titles of giallo films, you'll find that you have The Bird with the Crystal Plumage come out, and then various other titles that have a similar structure, where it'll be like, the rhino with a diamond toenail, something like that.
Yes.
That seems to get in on the same trend.
Oh, man, there's so many giallo movies with great titles, totally independent. A lot of times I don't even remember which movie the title goes with. There's one that always sticks in my mind called Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key.
Got to make copies of that key. Well, anyway, back to Fulci. He died in 1996, and his output slowed down later in life as he wrestled with health issues. But his next to last film was 1990's A Cat in the Brain, which I have not seen and really didn't know much about. I just kind of assumed it was just another standard, bloody Fulci affair. But it apparently stars a fictionalized version of himself. He plays this fictionalized version of himself in the film, seeking the aid of a twisted psychiatrist over his own violent visions. So I watched the trailer for it, and it looks amazing. It's a lot of Fulci ranting, dubbed into English for the version we would watch, where he's saying things like, "The man was all red, and I wanted to kill him," and then you'll cut to some sort of bizarre sequence.
Trying to understand the reception history of Fulci is interesting, because he seems like a figure who simultaneously it evokes a disgust reaction from people. And I think a lot of people would sort of look down on as a kind of lowbrow pervert of gore. Somebody who made these gross movies full of almost hilarious quantities of gratuitous blood and guts. And yet at the same time, I think there's a lot of film scholarship on Fulci. I sense that he enjoys a kind of special aura of artistic respect, set apart from most other directors of lowbrow B horror movies of this kind.
Yeah, I think part of it may be that he's important enough and ultimately impressive enough that he stands out. He kind of emerges out of that world of Italian B cinema, and therefore he might be the most notorious name that someone is familiar with from that world. But of course, if you dig a little deeper into Italian B cinema, you find plenty of other more notorious names. There are a lot more arguably unsavory characters than Lucio Fulci.
I mean, I guess the weird distinction here is that I bet at multiple colleges out there in the world, there are entire courses on Fulci. Like, he's at that level of subject matter worthy of critical analysis, I think.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage.
With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Well, let's look at some of the other names involved here. We also have Alessa Briganti, who has a story credit. This is an Italian screenwriter who wrote on such films as Zombie, Manhattan Baby, 1990, The Bronx Warriors, A Blade in the Dark, Hands of Steel, which we've discussed on the show before, and many more.
Hands of Steel was the Italian Terminator ripoff that had the big beefy guy who comes to the desert bar and then ends up in an arm wrestling scene.
Yeah, an Arizona movie filmed by Italians and also featuring John Saxon.
Oh, yeah, John Saxon. And and that movie was the one where we encountered the worst song of all time because the lead actress in it sings that pop single Teddy Bear.
I don't know. I kind of like Teddy Bear.
Teddy Bear. Okay.
I look back fondly on Teddy Bear. I don't remember it, though. I don't remember how it goes.
Oh, let me remind you.
No. Afterwards. Okay. So the next name worth pointing out, Dardano Sacchetti, has a screenplay credit. Born 1944, Italian screenwriter who worked on the likes with the likes of Lamberto Bava, Lucio Fulci, Enzo G. Castellari, Dario Argento. His first credit was Argento's The Cat of Nine Tails. He worked with Fulci quite a bit, including some of his most well-known films, some of the ones we've mentioned here already. He worked on Lamberto Bava's Monster Shark and Demons, and he also worked on 1990, The Bronx Warriors. So another important name in Italian B-cinema. And there's another screenplay credit to Giorgio Mariuzzo, who also wrote on the Fulci films The Beyond and Enigma, as well as some others.
Now, is House by the Cemetery sometimes considered part of a, I'm afraid I'm getting this wrong, but part of a sort of conceptual trio of horror films that Fulci did along with Gates of Hell and The Beyond? Is that right?
Yes. The so-called Gates of Hell trilogy of films. And I'm personally not sure if this is if this was dubbed a trilogy by Fulci himself, or if this is something that commentators and fans have come up with. But at any rate, yeah, we have these three films, City of the Living Dead from 1980 and The Beyond, and House by the Cemetery, both from 1981. And it is just so happens we have an actor that is in all three of these. It is Catherine McCall, or Catriona McCall. And she plays Lucy Boyle, the wife in this picture. She was born in 1954, British-born ballet dancer turned actor, in all three of the Gates of Hell films. She also was in 1980's Hawk the Slayer, which starred Jack Palance, as well as John Terry, Patricia Quinn, it looks pretty interesting. I can't remember if I've seen it or not. I may have seen it. She was also in 1991's Afraid of the Dark, which starred James Fox, Paul McGann, and David Thewlis.
Right. So I guess if we're getting into the cast, we should say that there's a main family in this movie, and Catherine McCall plays the mother in the family. The father is played by this guy named Paolo Malco.
Yeah. Plays Dr. Norman Boyle. Malco was born in 1947, an Italian actor who was also in Fulci's New York Ripper, was in Sergio Martino's The Scorpion with Two Tails. He was in Castellari's Escape the Bronx, as well as Lamberto Bava's Demons 3, The Ogre. That came out in 1989, and this one's it's kind of a weird connection here, because The Ogre is apparently very similar to this film, to House by the Cemetery, and it is apparently based on Sacchetti's original script for House by the Cemetery. So they went, this is according to Lamberto Bava. So basically they're like, well, you know, Fulci did some slightly different things with the script. Let's go back and we'll just do the script as it was before Fulci did what he did with it. So I don't know. I've not seen Demons 3. I think I've only seen Demons 1, so I can't speak to it personally.
I didn't know there was a Demons 3. Demons 1 and Demons 2. Demons 1 has a bunch of people go to a movie theater and they watch a movie and then demons attack. Demons 2 has a bunch of people in an apartment building and then demons attack. Demons 3, I guess it must be a house, so they're scaling back.
Well, I think it was very much a case of them making a film called The Ogre, again, based on this older script. And then they were like, well, maybe this will perform better if we just call it Demons 3. Why not? Are people going to complain that it doesn't match up all that well with the plot of Demons 1 and 2?
I think Demons 2, I don't recall much continuity between them. In fact, I even seem to recall that there are actors who are in the first movie playing different characters in the second Demons movie.
But anyway, Malco as Dr. Norman Boyle in this, pretty entertaining and has great hair in most of the scenes. There's some scenes of him standing on windswept streets in New York City. And you're like, wow, that's a good head of hair.
As Vincent Price would say, his hair is luxurious. Just absolutely wonderful hair. This is hair first casting, to be sure.
And, you know, it runs in the family because his son in the film, his son Bob, also has an impressive head of hair.
This is really the star of the film here, is Bob. Yeah. Years ago, when I first saw this movie, the movie in general didn't make all that much of an impression on me, except I remembered Bob. This movie has this weird, haunting child in it that's maybe actually the scariest thing in the movie, but also the funniest because he's named Bob and characters are constantly yelling out Bob.
Yes, Bob, an adult's name that is here given to a child.
Uh-huh.
A child that is also a child whose voice is dubbed into English and performed by an adult woman doing a child's voice. So that adds this extra level of the uncanny to it. And also, the actor playing Bob, Giovanni Frezza, who was born in 1972, was just a very cute child, just objectively extremely cute child who just comes off like a cherub, like an actual angelic being that seems to glow on the screen and in a way that just feels unnatural, just unnaturally cute, this kid.
The glowing quality also, like you say, it takes after his dad in this film. Luxurious hair, like glowing hair.
Yeah, just basically platinum. Now, the child actor here, Giovanni Frezza, pops up in an excellent assortment of Italian genre pictures from this time period, including Manhattan Baby, the excellent Warriors of the Wasteland, A Blade in the Dark, and the first Demons movie. Demons came out in 1985, and that was his last acting role. He grew up, apparently, to become a product development director, and I think still works and resides in the United States. I looked up some footage of him from a DVD or Blu-ray extra, and I am pleased to see that he did not turn into like a terrifying Klaus Kinski-looking adult dude. Because there's something about, like, he's so innocent and cute in this film. You're like, you can easily imagine it twisted into the grotesque and the cruel instead of growing up into what seems like probably a normal adult.
But you can confirm normal adult?
I mean, I don't know the guy, but you look at a picture of him and you're like, oh, that's a grown human being.
Normal that, looking that, adult.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, product development sounds normal enough, so anyway.
That can be anything. Stands out there. That can be final processing.
All right. So that is the family. That's our central trio here. But then you could basically look at the rest of the cast as by dividing them into like ghosts, monsters, and victims. So the main ghost is May. May, the ghost girl, played by Sylvia Colatina. Born 1972, and the interesting thing, and I guess this makes sense because of the rate at which girls and boys mature, but she's actually the same age as the actor playing Bob in this. She was also a child actor, active only from 1979 to 1984, but with fewer credits. She acted in Sergio Martino's The Great Alligator in 1979, a movie that has a story credit by George Eastman. And then she was also in Fulci's Murder Rock, Dancing Death in 1984.
I did not know Sergio Martino had an alligator movie. I got to look into that.
Yeah, penned by George Eastman.
Well,
sounds perfect.
Italian crocodilian movies can be quite... Have you ever seen... I forget the director's name. There are a couple of Italian horror films called Killer Crocodile and Killer Crocodile 2.
I don't think I've seen those.
They're extremely bad, but very funny.
Well, as for our ghost here, May, I feel like Caldatina's really good in this. You know, it's hard to judge a child actor, particularly if they're dubbed probably by like a different person. But I don't know. There's a certain quality to her delivery here where I totally buy her sense of like occasional detachment, but also kind of like shocked outrage at the danger that is lurking on the screen.
Yeah, she has a lot of like look into the camera, go wide-eyed and gasp kind of moments.
Yeah. The next character is kind of perplexing because depending on where you are in the film, it's hard to tell where she falls into this these divisions of victims and ghosts and monsters. This is the character of Anne the Babysitter, played by Ania Peroni. She was born in 1957, an Italian actor. She also appeared in Dario Argento's Tenebrae and Inferno, in which she apparently plays the Mother of Tears. She's fun in this as a mysterious character who does a lot of suspicious staring, a lot of silent staring. And I have to say, this new 2K release, this new 2K master of House by the Cemetery, it reveals every follicle in her lush lupine eyebrows. It's pretty great.
I was going to point out those eyebrows. So if Paolo Malco, if he was hair first casting, I think this actress was eyebrow first casting. It's all about the eyebrows here.
Yeah, I mean, she has really intense eyes as well, but luscious eyebrows. You've never seen eyebrows like these before. And she, a lot of the scenes, again, getting back to like Fulci never letting plot get in the way of a good scene. I think a lot of his direction was like, yes, stare hauntingly into the camera. Keep doing it. Okay, good. That's great. Now we'll move on to the next scene.
You almost wonder if a lot of scenes in this movie could have been done with the actors not even knowing yet what they were going to be looking at. It's just we get a lot of footage of the actor going like, oh, and then later we figure out what the image is that they're seeing.
Yeah, or sometimes we don't exactly.
Yeah.
One more actor to highlight, though we may come back to one or two more when we get into the plot, but we also have this realtor character. We have multiple realtor characters, but the main one is Laura, played by the actor Dagmar Lassander. She was born in 1943, a Czech-born actor who pops up in a lot of Italian films. And I don't know, perhaps she's just more memorable because of her name. You know, Dagmar Lassander. Lassander tends to stand out in the credits of a film. Her credits include Mario Bava's Hatchet for the Honeymoon, Lamberto Bava's Devil Fish, and also Fulci's The Black Cat. Also a picture unrelated to these filmmakers titled Werewolf Woman.
So she plays a character in this named, you said Laura, Mrs. Gittleson, right? This
Mrs. Same, Gittleson, yes.
Yeah, Miss Gittleson. She's the real estate agent, and there's a great scene where she is trying to back out of the driveway of the titular house, the house by the cemetery, and she like drives over a tombstone and just like swears at it. She's just like, ah, damn tombstones.
She's fun in it. She's fun. All right, well, let's get to the music, because the music on this film is definitely worth highlighting. This is a fun score. You know, it's a little bit, it's a little bit funky, definitely synthy, and apparently highly influential. I saw it pointed out that some of the music that was used or created for Garth Marenghi's Dark Place years later, it's kind of like a direct reference to the score to this film.
That makes so much sense. And a lot of what's funny about Garth Marenghi's Dark Place is just slightly tweaking things that are already true about House by the Cemetery. Like some of the kind of the vibe in the dialogue scenes with these long pauses between lines and awkward staring.
Yep, absolutely.
In fact, I even thought of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, and there's one part in the movie where Paolo starts listening to a tape by the old doctor that starts talking about blood, 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 and I wanted to complete it with, and bits of sick.
Yeah, I had the same thought. That's a great sequence, too, by the way. Yeah, listening to that. And aren't we getting, we're presented with visuals of blood flowing over a tombstone?
Yes.
All right. So the individuals responsible for this music, primarily Walter Rosati. I'm not sure when this Italian composer was born or if he's still with us. I couldn't find any dates on him, but he seems to have been primarily active from 1966 through 1993. His notable scores include this one, 1990, The Bronx Warriors, as well as some various action films. I think this is the main standout. But you also have Alexander Blanksteiner on this with an additional music credit. You might remember him as the guy who gave us that fabulously funky disco score for Cannibal Apocalypse. Mm. He has composition credit on 5 of the score's tracks. So it all comes together, again, into just a very fun score that is, occasionally... definitely gets into this kind of cheesy groove that only works with this film, but I think is overall pretty excellent and has some wonderful moments of horror synth working. I thought we might have a taste of it right here.
Yes, I love the synth pipe organs, and I also, at a couple of points, I was hearing a plinking walk down that reminds me of the melody from Bananarama's Cruel Summer.
Yeah, I think I know which part you're talking about. I need to go back and listen to that, though. And speaking of going back and listening to it, I should point out that that there have been some excellent re-releases of this score. I can't really speak to its digital availability on streaming sites, but you've had some fabulous vinyl editions put out by both Death Waltz Records, which excels at this sort of thing, as well as Burning Witch Records. So if you're into the vinyl and you're into scores like this, definitely check those out. Those were the humans, but there's also one non-human credit I need to give, and that's the house itself. This is one of those fabulous movies where we have a central haunted house or haunted location, and that location actually exists in the real world, and you can technically go and see it. Obey local laws as far as approaching it, but the house here is the Freudstein house is actually the Bailey Ellis house located on the Ellis estate in the coastal Massachusetts town of, I'm sure I'm going to butcher the name of this, Scituate?
Scituate? I have no idea. S-C-I-T-U-A-T-E. Scituate? Scituate? I don't know.
Yeah. At any rate, it's about 30 miles southeast of Boston. And according to Atlas Obscura, it's currently owned by the Scituate Arts Association. And if you go to their website, you can see recent photos of it. The website states, quote, "The Ellis House is a unique Gothic Romanesque mansion and home to the SAA's indoor classes and workshops. It also provides studio space for half a dozen artists." So, hey, go there, sign up to create your own entry for the night gallery. This house is still standing, and there's still wonderfully creative things going on inside it.
I will drop everything in my life and go to Massachusetts to become part of Dr. Freudstein's art collective.
And by the way, this house was also used in Umberto Lenzi's Ghost House. So you get to double dip by visiting this place.
It's a really good house, I will say.
Yeah, it's a handsome house, and they fix it up nicely for the film because they're just headstones everywhere, just all through the yard and then also in the surrounding woods.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, now here's the part of the episode where we would normally start getting into a full plot breakdown. I don't know if that's quite the terminology to use here. I think what happens is we are going to be able to describe a bunch of scenes that happen in the movie, but I don't know if we can really explain the plot.
Right. I mean, there's still things I do not understand. And I've seen this film more than I've seen some truly, subjectively great works of art. I've also, especially in this last viewing, I really tried to understand everything. You know, it was like I was going to be quizzed on it. Can I really speak to what's happening in this movie? And I really can't explain some of the choices and elements here, though I will try.
We will at least try to describe a number of the dioramas that Fulci creates in the shoebox of this film.
Yes.
So from the very opening, I got to say, especially with this restoration, it looks great. The house is beautifully framed on the opening shot with the, it's got the dark in the background with tombstones and dead limbs in the foreground. I can't remember if you mentioned this a minute ago. Is there actually a cemetery by the house, or were the tombstones added for the film?
I think the tombstones were added for the film. I'm not 100% clear on that, but I didn't see anybody pointing out there being an actual cemetery surrounding this house.
Okay, well, we see it in the opening frame like this beautiful old house with the darkness behind it and the tombstones and the dead trees with bare limbs in the foreground. And this, of course, is setting up a classic horror movie style opening in which some people are in a place they're not supposed to be, and they're probably about to meet an ill end.
Right. It's ultimately a familiar scene. I feel like I've seen in other films. A woman is dressing, and then she starts looking around the house for her boyfriend, assuming he's pranking her by suddenly disappearing. And then, so she wanders around being like, oh, what is his name? Is it Mike?
Steve.
It's Steve. She's like,
Steve,
oh,
Steve, are you there?
Steve, stop kidding around, Steve. And then, of course, what happens? She discovers Steve. Steve is dead. He's been nailed to the backside of a door with a pair of surgical scissors, and his brain has been surgically or through blunt trauma exposed. And then an unseen killer stabs her through the back of the head with a kitchen knife so that the end of the blade emerges out of her mouth. And then she falls to the floor dead. And then a pair of hands, one of which appears human and one of which appears to be a monster hand, drags her away into the cellar.
So a standard B-horror opening, but there's a lot stylistically about it that's just very elegant and very much a cut above what you would see in movies like this normally. So one thing I wanted to draw attention to was a wonderful shot where while she is wandering around calling out to Steve, saying like, "Steve, are you trying to scare me? I don't think it's funny." But she's coming down a hallway that is lit from behind. And in the foreground, we are looking through the gaps in an iron spiral staircase that's just covered in cobwebs. And it's a gorgeous shot.
Yeah, yeah. And a great shot of this seemingly endless cellar in this this house. I mean, it's supposed to be a haunted house, so it makes sense that maybe the cellar doesn't obey the laws of reality and space and time. But yeah, it seems enormous, and it seems like there are corners of it that haven't been explored in like a century and a half. I ultimately love the unreality of this cellar.
But then after the opening murders, you get some music, of course, this electronic organ fugue. You get the title. It says House by the Cemetery. And then there's an interesting compositional shift coming up. So you see the same house and a girl standing in the window looking out, making kind of a scary screaming face, which then crossfades to a black and white photograph hanging on a wall of that house with the girl looking out the window with the screaming face. Then you see a title that says New York. Pulls back. The wall is in a modern apartment, modern at the time the film was made. And then sitting there staring at the photo is a profoundly uncanny blonde child. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Bob.
I want to come back to that ghost girl for a second because, yes, she's haunting in the photo, but the face she's making, it could be interpreted as fear, but it's also the kind of face that a child like this would make when somebody does a cannonball into a swimming pool in a Kool-Aid commercial. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Whoa! Like, yeah. Yeah. That's radical.
And it is radical. But yes, now we meet Bob. And we say we meet the whole family. Yeah, there's Dr. Norman Boyle. There's his wife, Lucy Boyle. There is adorable Bob, who we've already described, disturbingly cherubic, and speaks in the dubbed voice of an adult woman doing a kid's voice.
It's so uncanny.
Yeah. And there are a lot of scenes, too, of Bob playing just way too diligently with his toys. Like, who has ever given a remote control car to a child and seen them and get this much usage out of it? It's really not fair.
Well, this movie also, I'm not sure if it understands that remote control cars don't work in the woods where the ground is covered in leaves and is not flat.
Yeah.
Oh, but so here's a question I have. Mm-hmm. Is Bob like Danny Torrance? Like, is he psychic, or is just the ghost girl picking him as a regular non-psychic person to send messages to?
I don't know. I mean, May only speaks to Bob, right? Bob seems to be the only one who can see her. So it's either she can speak to him because he's a child, or he's a special child. But I have a suspicion that the idea is that children are weird and can see ghosts.
Okay. So it's not him in particular. He's just a child, and the child's mind is open to the spirit world in a way that the adult's mind is closed.
I guess so. But ultimately, that's just how I choose to interpret it. And I'm not sure where Fulci actually stood on this.
Well, immediately what happens here is that Lucy, the mother, comes in and is like, "Hey, Bob." And Bob's like, "Well, I'm hearing voices talking to me out of this photograph." And she's just like, "Oh, haha." and he's like, "Mommy, why does that girl in the photograph keep telling us we shouldn't go to the house?" And the mom can't see the girl in the window in the photo. So she just kind of shrugs it off. Mm. But then we see a kind of alternate reality where May, the ghost girl, and I guess her mom are standing in the woods somewhere. I guess they are standing among the tombstones in the cemetery outside the house, and we're told that this is in New Whitby, Boston.
Yeah, yeah. This film, most of these scenes were filmed in Massachusetts, take place in Massachusetts, and this is ultimately a Massachusetts film. Maybe our first. I'm not sure if we've, I can't remember if any of the previous films we've watched have been set or filmed there.
I believe this film is sort of trying to tap into some Miskatonic magic.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But that doesn't mean we don't have a brief stop over in New York City. On the streets of New York, Dr. Norman Boyle is seen chatting with Professor Mueller, who is played by the director, Lucio Fulci, and they're discussing Boyle's research. He is about to move his entire family out of the city into rural Massachusetts so that he can continue the suicide research that his colleague Dr. Peterson was doing right before said colleague murdered his mistress and committed suicide himself. Now, what sort of research could this possibly have been? What breakthroughs was he making? I have no idea. And there's not a lot there are not really any answers to be found in the film.
What a setup. And yeah, this scene on the sidewalk is hilarious. And I think maybe it's supposed to be. I don't think this is unintentional because Fulci is talking to this lead actor here with, you know, the glorious head of hair. And Fulci's, I guess, playing an older colleague who's got this ridiculous huge red bow tie and these thick glasses. And as he's talking to Paolo here, Norman Boyle, he says, and there he was researching suicide, times we have to live in. Taxi! And he just hails a taxi, hops in, and takes off.
That's just New York living.
Yeah.
You gotta keep moving, otherwise the Manhattan babies will catch up with you.
So next the family is driving out to the house, and this is one of the parts where I heard that that walk down melody that sounds like a Muzak version of Cruel Summer. But this is also at the part where the dad is talking about how if it weren't for so-and-so, I don't remember who he's talking about, we wouldn't have a house to live in where we're going. We'd have to live in a tent. And Bob yells, I wish.
Well, that's pretty authentic. That's pretty good.
There's a scene that comes up in a minute here that is great that has May, the ghost girl, who, by the way, doesn't look like a ghost. She just looks like a normal person, just like a kid.
Yeah.
Not like, translucent or anything. So it's just like a kid is out on a street. I think this is supposed to be in Boston or this town outside of Boston that they're going to. And she is staring into the window of a storefront that has mannequins dressed up in, I guess, the clothes the store is selling. And so one of these mannequins looks like a very evil Denise Richards type face and is wearing one of those, what do you call those frilly white collars that look kind of like doilies?
Yeah, kind of like a witch costume, I guess. It looks a little witchy. Sort of.
But then it's like May hallucinates the mannequin getting decapitated and it bleeds everywhere. So this is a mannequin, but it's full of blood and organs and stuff. The head falls off and it's just splatter for a moment. And then somehow this leads into the meeting of May and Bob, which is very funny as well. Like Bob shows up in town, his parents go in to talk to the realtors and he's just sitting in the car, I think playing with the toy. And then suddenly they're like psychic mind melding.
Yeah. Like she's a block or two away and they're just chatting with each other. Like they're right next to each other through their brains.
Oh, and somehow this sequence ends with Bob like sitting in a park, cradling this gigantic, horrible doll.
Yeah, this giant garbage doll that he's been given, I guess, by May. He's like, Mom, we're taking this home, right? And they're like, yeah, load it up. Load up your garbage doll.
But so from here, we get the family moving into the new house, and there's a lot of great photography. We get to see them interacting with the realtors. This is where there's that funny scene where Ms. Gittleson drives over a tombstone and then yells at it. And Lucy, the mother, has this strange freak out about the doll that Bob found. It's like, but it's after they get back to the house. So I didn't really understand that. He brings this disgusting doll home and then it's sitting there in the house and she sees it and she's like, does a whip zoom on her eyes. This movie loves whip zooms, by the way. Did you notice that?
Now that you pointed out, yeah, there's a lot of whip zooming going on.
Sometimes in situations where it wouldn't seem to make total sense, like, it will happen in cases where somebody's having a horrible vision, but it also sometimes just happens in the middle of a conversation.
Yeah. Now, this is the point in the film where we introduce one of my favorite characters, and we've already talked a little bit about her, the actor playing her, but Anne, the babysitter with the magnificent eyebrows, shows up. And apparently, we're supposed to connect her to the mannequin that we saw. The mannequin that's head fell off in the window is supposed to look like this actor.
Yeah.
Even though she really doesn't, and I got more caught up on the fact that she looks like a particular former first lady of the United States.
God,
but
kind
it's supposed
of, yeah.
to be Anne. It's supposed to be Anne, apparently.
I didn't notice that, but yeah, you're right. But yeah, well, I was thinking Denise Richards, but either way, yeah, it doesn't exactly look like Anne. I guess it has long brown hair and intense eyebrows. So there you go. But anyway, when Anne shows up, she's just a lady in their house suddenly. They're unpacking or something, and suddenly a person's there, and they're all like, huh? And she says, Miss Gittleman sent me. I'm Anne, the babysitter. And then just zoom, whip, zoom, cut.
So this is just instantly just so insane because, I mean, in what universe does a realtor provide your babysitter?
Yeah.
In which case does a babysitter just sort of appear without, you know, there are no credentials. Like the parents weren't involved in this at all. They just suddenly, they have this strange woman in their house babysitting for them. And then various other questions come up regarding Anne and this whole babysitting arrangement and her relationship with any other entity in the film. It's bonkers.
From moment one, Anne appears to be up to no good. Like the so from here, the family starts going about their business, and Norman is, I think, trying to discover what the scholar who lived in this house before him was up to, like what he had found out and what had led him to do these horrible things. And meanwhile, there's like a scene where Lucy is walking around at night, having heard strange sounds in the house, and she just like comes up on Anne, who is trying to pry her way into the boarded up basement with a shovel, and gives her the most evil, just hyena eyes.
So Anne lives in the house with them, right? She's like a live-in babysitter. Like basically she's a nanny. Even though they don't really use the word, that's apparently what they mean, nanny. But then at the same time, like the relationship is so weird. There's a point later on where Anne disappears from the film for good, and the mom comes home, finds that Anne is no longer around, and is just Bob by himself, and she just dismisses it. She's like, oh, I guess Anne went home to see her parents.
Yeah.
there's no communication with the babysitter / nanny. It's just like, oh, well, she's done. She wandered off. That's fine. That's what babysitters do.
That is the end of Anne, the au pair.
And yet there's still more questions about Anne we'll get to as we proceed.
So where is it after this? We follow Norman for a bit because he's trying to figure out what was going on with Dr. Peterson's research. And he goes to some place that has a library. I guess it's supposed to be a university. Like, is this Miskatonic University or something?
Yeah, I think we're getting kind of that kind of vibe. You know, this is the Arkham Horror section of the movie where he's going and researching the strange research of his predecessor.
Yeah, and so he meets a scholar there who's got like this awesome looking beard, and the scholar's like, you've been here before with your daughter. And Norman is like, nope, I've never been here before and I don't have a daughter. And does that ever come up again? I don't recall that connecting to anything.
I didn't really understand that. Like, where they, at first I was like, they just mistook Bob for a girl, which, you know, it's the misgendering of children happens all the time.
Sure.
You know, with when you're a parent or when you're talking to parents. So I thought, well, maybe that's it. But no,
but I don't think so. He'd never been there.
But then who was it? But we get to meet the librarian in this sequence, right? The librarian was a lot of fun. It's a small role, but it's played by this guy, Giampaolo Saccarola, perhaps, playing the librarian. And he's I really like this guy. He has some real Ronald Lacey energy. You know, he's got kind of a devious baby face.
Yes, yes, yes. He reminds me a little bit of Dylan Baker, you know, the actor. But either way, he's a stupendous baby-faced Renfield boiling over with nervous laughter. I loved his scenes.
Yeah, he ultimately doesn't play a particularly devious character. He doesn't, you know, this is not a character that turns out later to be a ghost or a cult member or anything weird like that. He just is this slightly suspicious librarian, and it's he's a fun screen presence. Apparently shows up in a number of other Italian B movies of this time period.
Yeah, just a bookish weirdo. There's also an awesome scene later on in the movie where he's wearing a green sweater that looks like it's made of felt. So he comes in, he's like a walking pool table. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's actually got some fun dialogue in that part, because it's mm-hmm. like he's coming off a little passive aggressive. He's like, I was just checking on the room because the library is closed on Sundays. And meanwhile, our hero's like, I'm here to research.
Yeah. Have you seen my hair? Do you know who I am?
Look how handsome I am. How dare you question my presence here?
There's a scene somewhere after this that's really funny, where Bob is out in the woods with his remote control race car. Again, like, you can't really play with a remote control car in the woods. And he's wandering around and he finds a tombstone for somebody named Mary Freudstein. And then he immediately has this incomprehensible encounter with the ghost girl, May, where May says, she says a line like, it's all a lie. She's not really buried there. Oh, I know. She's not really buried there. I don't know what that means.
Yeah. I don't know either, because she's a ghost, but I guess I don't know where she's buried if she's not buried here.
So this is all while Norman in his library is learning about the sort of unsavory history of a Dr. Jacob Freudstein, who I think at one point lived in the house that they're staying in now. So this is not the guy who was there before them, but the guy who was there before that guy.
Right. And this is when we find out that this isn't just a house by the cemetery. It is perhaps a house on the cemetery, or more specifically, the cemetery is also inside the house.
The cemetery is coming from inside the house.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene that sets that up, by the way, begins with an absolutely gorgeous framing. So, like, this house has these stained glass windows with these, like, green and yellow and purple flower shapes that are framed against this blue stained glass. It's just wonderful. And this is the framing for when Lucy's, like, washing the floor, and she pulls aside a rug and discovers under the rug there's just a tomb. There's like a gravestone inside the house.
And we'll later find out that in kind of Scooby-Doo fashion, this tombstone is also a secret door, like a trap door that gives you entryway into the cellar.
Right.
In addition to the door that nobody can open yet, that clearly goes to the cellar.
Right. Yeah. And like in this scene, there's a bunch of grunts and jostling and whatnot coming from the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of indicates the trapdoor thing.
Yeah, there are a lot of haunted sounds in this house. Like there's creaking, there's progressively grunting, and also like ghost baby weeping. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in this house from an auditory point of view here.
So Lucy is not happy about this, and she screams, but eventually she and Norman are discussing it, and Lucy's like, wow, it's weird that there's a tomb inside the house, and Norman says, it's just something you'll have to get used to. This ain't New York.
Yeah, it's implied, like, this is just what they do out here.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, is this ever a thing? I don't think I've ever visited a historic home where they're like, and now you'll notice there's a gravestone in the middle of the house. This is what they did.
I'm open-minded, but I'm a little doubtful on that. I don't know. Listeners, yeah. Write in. Do houses in New England all have bodies buried in the floors? Oh, and another thing, by the way, that was right in the middle of the sequence, there's a part where Norman is standing in the kitchen, and it's one of those things where I think we've talked about how a great thing with some of these Italian horror directors is they really know how to put a colorful item or two in the middle of an otherwise color drab shot to just really make it pop and add some contrast. Mm-hmm. And in one of these shots, the colorful item in the foreground is this big red box of something called Fiddle Faddle. It looks like it's I don't know. It looks like Cracker Jacks or something. It might be caramel popcorn.
Yeah. Watching this scene, I also thought back to our recent viewing of Mario Bava's Black Sabbath, and was thinking about, yeah, how he'll put just some sort of item, it doesn't even matter what it is, in the center, and the color will just suck you in. This doesn't quite pull that off, but you can see that Fulci was going for the same sort of effect.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
But I guess this is all leading up to one of the finest sequences in the entire film, which is the bat scene. The bat scene is so good, and it comes from the first time the family actually decides to venture into the basement. So earlier, Anne was trying to pry her way into the basement in the middle of the night. Nobody ever explained that. I don't know why. She doesn't explain why. I don't think the movie addresses why she was trying to pry in. If it does, then I missed it. But eventually the whole family goes in, and there's this great scene of Norman, the dad, trying to unlock the door to the basement by prying at the key with the sharp edge of a kitchen knife. So he's got a kitchen knife like wedged in it, blade out, like blade poking into the metal of the key, and just wrenching it over to turn the lock.
One of several scenes where people are opening doors using knives in the most unsafe manner possible. Yeah. In a way, it's very effective because you can't help but cringe watching them do this.
Fulci actually, scenes from this movie could be used as a video version of the Don't Do What Donnie Don't Does book about knife safety.
Yeah, it's basically, it's shake hands with danger, but generally, but I guess the thing is you keep expecting that knife to slip and there to be a real bloody gore effect, and then there's not. But then what happens instead is, yeah, they open the door successfully with their knife, and then they start heading down there to check it out. I think Dad's in front, right, with the flashlight and all.
Yeah.
And then in swoops the bat.
The bat.
And this is a great scene because the bat latches onto Norman's hand, and then he still has a knife, so he stabs it like a million times, like backing up out of the cellar into the kitchen, just still stabbing at this bat that's affixed to his hand, producing about six bats worth of blood in the process and just getting it everywhere.
Yeah, flinging bat blood on everyone in the room, and it's just stuck on his hand like a leech. Like it's just you can't pull it off, and he's just stabbing and stabbing and getting blood on his whole family, and it's absolutely ludicrous. This scene is everything. By the way, I got to say, it compares quite favorably to another bat attack film from an Italian horror movie. Do you remember the bat scene in Suspiria?
I do not.
Very funny, but underwhelming compared to this one. So whereas this bat attack is just the paragon of excess, the bat attack in Suspiria is where Jessica Harper is in her room at the school, and suddenly she gets creeped out by, it's just like a ball of black socks with wings. It's not a good bat.
1 to 10 on the bat believability scale. What do you give the Suspiria bat?
The Suspiria bat would be like a 2 or a 3. This one, I don't know if believability is the word, but it so overwhelms the senses that one need not believe either way. It's just there. It's just in you.
All right. So I'm going to mark you down for a 5.
On this okay.
One. But the other thing is this scene reminded me of the Simpsons where Homer gets his hand stuck in the toaster.
Yes.
And then, like, still has his hand stuck in the toaster.
Yeah. Dad, it's in there again.
All right, so eventually the bat is vanquished, and at that point, I think everybody's had enough of the cellar, and they have agreed not to go back in there for the time being.
Well, and we're to understand that after the scene, the family expresses their desire to leave the house, because the next is at the real estate office. You've got the two realtors sitting there, and they're just talking about how, everybody always wants out of this house. Why won't people just stay in the house?
And this is great because we don't get enough scenes of realtors talking to realtors in our movies, particularly in our haunted house films. You know, maybe the owners or the renters are talking with the realtor, but not this kind of inside realtor talk.
You get, so one of the realtors is the one we've already met, Miss Gittleston. Mm-hmm.
This one played by Dagmar.
Yes, and then the other one is this guy who I don't know if he has a name, but he has. A powerful aura of sleaze.
Yes.
And then, so after this, I don't know if this has any causal relationship to anything else in the movie, but we get at least one scene of, like, the ghost people in their own environment, like May and her mom, just in a house hanging out. And May is depicted as dwelling within a gin pop of a Supermax prison for dolls. It's, you know, just dolls everywhere crammed in. You imagine that the dolls are, like, you know, shoving each other for more personal space. And they have some kind of conversation here in the house. And I think this is implied to be the same house, but, like, not in a different reality version of the house.
Yeah, and I'm not sure where to fall on this. Like, this room and also, to a large extent, the cellar, are these places that are that physically exist and are closed off from the rest of the house, like the main, I presume, rental house? I forget if they were supposed to have purchased this house, or surely they're renting. You don't just buy a haunted house, you want to rent. But I don't know if these are rooms that physically exist or if they are essentially ghost rooms and ghost domains. And ultimately, the house by the cemetery is kind of like the house of leaves and doesn't obey, you know, the typical laws of time and space.
That's a nice comparison. Except I would say House of Leaves is somehow less confusing than House by the Cemetery. So from here, the movie kind of ramps up more into attack mode. Multiple characters are going to get slaughtered by the monster here. There's a scene where the real estate agent, Ms. Gittleson, just kind of pops into the house to wander around. There's some beautiful eerie shots of the house, like that same window, the bay of windows with the the stained glass and all that. And there are these lamps, these globe-shaped lamps beside them. It's wonderful, wonderful composition. But so this lady's wandering through the house and she gets attacked by the tomb, like the stone slab over the tomb that Lucy discovered there. It bites her leg, essentially. And then she is killed by the monster hand guy from the beginning of the movie.
And that's the doctor. That's Dr. Freudstein, who we will increasingly see a lot more of.
Right. Well, we don't see him. It's still just his hands here. Like, that's the big reveal at the end of the movie, is getting to see his full form. Here you just get hands, and then this lady gets murdered in a scene of an absolutely ridiculous excess of blood.
Yeah, this is, he stabs her with a poker multiple times.
Yeah. So sometime around this point in the movie, also Norman discovers the cassette tapes made by his predecessor, by the previous scholar who was working in this house. And this guy Peterson, and Peterson's recording himself talking into a tape recorder about the Freudstein house. He seems to be losing his mind. He says, "The house, it draws me like an infernal magnet. How many have wandered into the waiting spider web? The smell of the rooms terrifies me." And then eventually we get to him saying, "Blood, blood, blood," which of course it will be irresistible to all the Garth Marenghi fans out there.
Yes.
But then the scenes right after that are really full of Stop and Shop. So like the mom comes home with the grocery bag that has the Stop and Shop logo on them. Honest values are what Stop and Shop is all about. And then there's Stop and Shop brand cartons of milk everywhere.
Yep. Adding that, some level of that red Mario Bava pop to the background.
Yeah. But here characters really start going down in the basement. So like Anne's going to go down in the basement. Bob's going to go down in the basement. This is third act territory here.
Yeah. So first of all, one of the people that goes down into the basement is Anne. And this is ultimately a sequence that really raises a lot, even more questions for me, because after the real estate lady is again just brutally murdered in the upper portion of the house and then dragged into the cellar, it appears that Anne has spent quite a bit of time cleaning up after this murder. Mom comes back. Apparently, they went out to a restaurant last night. They had invited Anne, but Anne was going to go "quote unquote" visit her parents. Which apparently means clean up after the murderous creature / ghost / whatever that lives in the cellar. And then she just kind of avoids the topic about what she's doing. But she's like clearly cleaning up all this blood. So it's like, is Anne working for the presence in the basement? Is she a thrall of the forces in this house? What is it? It's not explained. And then when Anne goes looking for Bob, wanders into the basement, the force brutally murders her, like chops her head off with a knife. And so it's like, well, what was that all about then? What, did she work for the thing in the basement? Did she work for some other force? Like, what is the arrangement here? I have no idea.
Yeah, I could not understand it all. At first, it seems like she is working for the monster, and then she's surprised when she encounters it. And so I don't know.
Yeah.
Why was she cleaning up the blood? Yeah.
Yeah, she died like she lived, a complete mystery. Okay, but when Bob's in the basement, then this is where the cellar really takes on this strange otherworldly dimension, because there are these sounds and creepy and also creepy sights. We keep seeing these big beast eyes glowing in the dark that remind me of the eyes of the crate dweller from Stephen King's Creepshow. And it's easy to think when you first see them, oh, these must be the eyes of the presence in the basement. These are the eyes of Dr. Freudstein. But as we'll explain, when we finally see Dr. Freudstein, he does not have these eyes.
No.
So what was this? Is this another presence? Is this another, like, is this like, I have so many questions about the whole arrangement here with ghosts and potentially demonic presences and also, artificially living undead creatures. It's really out there. I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, same here. Just these weird glowing yellow and red cat-like eyes in the dark that don't correspond to any creature or monster we see later in the film.
But one of the key sequences is this scene, yeah, where Bob is shut into the closet. Whatever's in the basement is able to close the door at will and trap people who wander down. Bob is stuck in the basement. Mom's trying to free him from the other side, and something's coming up the stairs to get him. It, of course, is the doctor, Dr. Freudstein.
Now, we don't fully see his face yet. That reveal mm-hmm. is still coming. But one of the funniest parts, again, is that Lucy is trying to get in to help Bob, and she's literally prying at the basement door with a kitchen knife. So just the knife yeah. in the door jamb, just prying. And then that doesn't work. And then I think this is when Norman comes home. And he attacks the door with a hatchet to try to get in and save Bob. There again was a very funny moment where he goes, "Keep away from the door." And Bob goes, "Yep, I will." And then
here comes the monster hand and holds Bob's head against the door while Dad's trying to hack through it with the hatchet.
Yes.
It's pretty great. I mean, it's terrifying. It's really an ingenious scene. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this.
And the dad accidentally chops the monster's arm off with the hatchet.
Mm-hmm.
Then also keeps hacking at the door in a very inefficient way, like hitting the door in completely different places, like in the middle and then at the side.
Yeah. And finally, we do get to see our monster, our Dr. Freudstein, in full. And, oh, man, I've long loved this monster design. So he is apparently a 150-year-old surgeon who really liked illegal surgeries. He's beat death through some mix of butchery and cell theft. And when I say beat death, you know, it's arguable, like, how close the score was here, because his body is just this desiccated husk of scars and rot with seemingly new parts added as needed. I think that's the reason he has one monster arm and one seemingly normal arm. Mm-hmm. He's clearly lost all of his humanity. And now just exists as this thing that lures people into the cellar so it can cut them to ribbons and, you know, maybe harvest some of their cells or their body parts. He boasts amazing strength to match his brutality. He can't speak or doesn't seem to. He seems to only emit guttural sounds. And we don't know if this is due to his state of mind, like is his brain just rotting in there, or is it just because he doesn't have, you know, functional speech apparatus anymore. He also may have supernatural powers. Like, he may be the one that's opening and closing that door, or he's aided by the ghosts of his family, or I was trying to figure out, well, maybe it has something to do with those beast eyes in the cellar. Maybe, like, he somehow horcruxed himself, and so he exists both as an incorporeal, like, presence in the cellar, but then also this doomed, you know, corporeal rotting creature. It's wonderful. Like the suit looks really good. You can basically smell him.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The design of the monster is absolutely fabulous. Especially the head, where his head is, it's almost like a wax helmet of a kind.
Yeah.
With these deeply recessed eye sockets that don't appear to have eyes in them. And no mouth. Yeah, the mouth part is just kind of smoothed over and is just this vertical scar now. It's excellent.
Yeah, there's kind of a body's exhibit sensibility to his head, like he's been plasticized. Oh, and then when Dad gets in there and stabs him, and when Dad stabs him, another one of the most memorable scenes in the film, is what comes out is not blood, but this just kind of rotted sludge filled with squirming maggots. I mean, just packed with maggots, and not mealworms, as is sometimes the case. Sometimes you have mealworms standing in for maggots, but this is the real deal. This is just a big maggoty sludge that starts dripping out of his body.
Yeah, a tremendously gross and in some ways beautiful monster design.
Now, here are the big spoilers. What happens when the family, the final three, go up against Dr. Freudstein? Well, it doesn't go so well. Dad, you know, gets in there and gets some stabbing in on Dr. Freudstein, but then Dr. Freudstein rips Dad's throat out in a very grisly sequence. And then Mom and Bob are going up these stairs to that tombstone trap door and trying to force it open so that they can escape. And Freudstein ends up grabbing Mom and like dragging her down the stairs, bonking her head on each rung. And then, like, and I think this must have been a, I don't know if this was a cut scene, but like the next scene you see is like her head has been dashed to pieces on the concrete floor. And then the creature's coming back up. Freudstein's coming back up to get Bob. And Bob manages to squeeze his way out and is pulled to safety by May, the ghost girl.
Yeah, so I was confused about the ending. Does Bob escape the monster by becoming a ghost?
I don't know. Does this mean Bob dies or Bob crosses over, or has Bob been saved in the physical world by May? I'm not sure.
I really don't. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I think it's intentionally haunting and vague. And Fulci does nothing to clear it up by having the final shot in the film be this this wide shot of the house again. And then there's a quote there attributed to Henry James. It says, "No one will ever know whether children are monsters or monsters are children."
So I want to reveal something. This didn't exactly sound like Henry James to me. And I was like, I wonder if that's an authentic quote. I looked it up. It appears it is not. I could not find this as a Henry James quote anywhere, and I could find people saying that Fulci made this up and attributed it falsely to Henry James. Why pick Henry James? I'm not sure. I mean, Henry James, like, what's the connection there? I guess James wrote Turn of the Screw, which is a horror classic. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't know.
I have no idea. I mean, maybe he was just inspired by the works of Henry James and
yeah,
just wanted to throw in a quotation, but then not a real quotation.
I don't know. Good choice either way.
Good choice. So there you have it. House by the Cemetery. There's so much to love in this one.
Well, so one of the things I did think was actually kind of interesting toward the end was, did I understand correctly that a lot of the times the characters have heard a sound of a child sobbing and they thought it was Bob. And so they were looking for Bob, but it wasn't Bob. It turns out it was the monster, and the monster was sobbing with the voice of a child.
I'm not sure. Possibly, but also I think those are possibly just ambient ghost noises, like ghosts of all the children. Because we get these scenes of all these other bodies that have been cut to pieces down there. We see at one point like a slaughtered child that looks a little bit like Bob. And I don't know if this is a vision of the potential future or this is a child that was killed in the past. I think there's that's during the playing of the haunted tape.
Oh yeah, the haunted cassette tape.
Where Dr. Peterson is like, "Oh, not the children, the children."
It's labeled, I think it says Peterson Personal.
Yes. And you remember what Norman does with that after he's through listening to it? He's like, "Well, this is going directly into the fire that's burning in the library on a Sunday when it's closed. Why is there an open brazier in the library?" Is
that to keep the tape,
keep the place warm, or just in case cursed documents or recordings are found? There's like a sign saying, "Remember, if you find a cursed document or cassette tape in the library, incinerate immediately." Be considerate of others.
I mean, I got to say, we're deep enough in the dream logic of the plot by that point. It feels right.
Yeah.
So I guess that's House by the Cemetery.
That is it. House by the Cemetery. So this one is this one's pretty widely available at this point. You can ultimately find it streaming a lot of places, and the version streaming you can purchase or rent digitally. I find that it tends to be the restored version. That's the version I watched. I watched the first half of it on my trial of AMC Plus in Apple, and then my trial ran out, and I had to switch to a trial of like Showtime or something to finish watching it. So I took the cheapskate approach, but I was also very tempted to pick up the handsome Blue Underground Blu-ray of this, which has fully restored, but also, the version I was looking at, it comes with all these behind-the-scenes features, and also it comes with the soundtrack as a CD, which was very tempting as well.
Oh, yeah, sounds like a steal.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it up here. We're gonna close up the House by the Cemetery. We're gonna put the realtor's lock on the front door, and we'll be back next week with another weird film. But yeah, thanks again for everyone who's enjoyed these or put up with these episodes over the past year. If you want to listen to more episodes of Weird House Cinema, we air it every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're primarily a science podcast, believe it or not. And we do our core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I know it's kind of hard to tell during the month of October because we have a lot of creepy content thrown in there if you're just discovering us or something. But yeah, core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Artifact or Monster Fact on Wednesday. On Monday, we have listener mail. And over the weekend, we air a rerun.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.